This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm your host, Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here. Coming up, we look at Cinco de Mayo in Liberty. Plus, we get the latest local news when Ruby Rayner of the River Reporter joins us live coming up. We start tonight with the Skinner's Falls Bridge, which connects Sullivan County in New York with Wayne County in Pennsylvania. It was built in the early 1900s, listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and it is also considered a contributing resource to the Milanville Historic District. And it's within the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River, which is managed by the National Park Service. Beyond its historical significance, the single-lane bridge is also of interest to business owners who cater to visitors and recreational users, such as Lou's Tubes on the New York side of the river and the Milanville General Store. The future of the bridge, which has been closed since October 2019 after years of emergency repairs, closings, and reopenings, future of the bridge has been the source of angst among some residents who revere the piece of infrastructure as both practical and historical. The Pennsylvania Department of Transportation held an unusually formatted public hearing last week on the future of the bridge, inviting members of the public to move freely among various stations to ask questions of contractors and PennDOT representatives stationed at informational boards at the Narrowsburg Union. Tim Bruno spoke with Meg McGuire, publisher and founder of Delaware Currents, the news project dedicated to telling the story of the Delaware River, about this event.
Chris Melly, who actually wrote the story, has a great lead. He basically says that the venue ended up looking like a science fair with all the little projects, or one of those poster sessions that some of the conferences were familiar with. And there were people there to answer questions. But, of course, what they didn't have, what's the usual sort of call and response, which is that people address the entire sort of officialdom and people hear each other's comments. So there were, you know, different sorts of knots of people. And I would say, not really surprisingly, the people who showed up for this were people who generally fall into a preference of a more traditional rehab of the bridge, keeping a lot of its character. I think many of the people who have been interested in the bridge know that it has several, built in the 1900s, it's listed on the National Register of Historic Places. It's also a contributing resource, as they call, to the Milanville Historic Visit District, and is also within the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River. So there's a couple of different reasons to be mindful of its character. It is, of course, right now closed. It has been closed for quite a while, I think, since 2019.
Yeah.
Before 2019, it had been open and closed at various times because they have been doing some major and occasionally minor repairs on the bridge. Right now, it's a one-lane bridge, and there's no specific pedestrian or bicycle crossing. The alternative that most of the people present at that meeting tended to prefer something that is costing out at about $19 million, which is to retain the bridge's significant architectural features, maintain it at a one-lane bridge, but adding pedestrian and bike crossing ability. People are concerned about certainly the most expensive possibility was $26 million, and that's to sort of bring it up to probably a two-lane highway and ability to carry 10 tons. I don't think any of the people that we spoke to that night were particularly interested in that solution. It takes away the character of the bridge, and it also might increase heavyweight traffic on local roads, which then they themselves would need to be repaired. It is, of course, important for the people, especially who live on the Pennsylvania side, the Wayne County side of the bridge, because that's their best access to the things they need to get to. What they do now requires about a 15-minute detour. Maybe that's not a big amount of time, but it's that's considerable when you start thinking of emergency services, either a particular person needing emergency transport to a local hospital, or if fire and rescue people have to get to the other side of the river, and how much longer it's going to take them to get there. So it's certainly it's a concern, and it's a costly operation. I think there was even a mention that it's going to cost $2.5 million to do nothing. I'm not sure exactly where that comes from. Maybe it's picking up the pieces of the bridge as it falls into the river. But anyway, yeah, it's still, even just to leave it alone is going to be costly.
So there's this public comment period that goes until May 26th. And as we said, it's been closed since 2019. Any ideas why it's taking so long, or is this just par for the course when it comes to historic bridges crossing the Delaware River?
To be honest, I'm not exactly sure of all of the reasons why it's taken so long. I think some of those pieces of the puzzle that I mentioned, the fact that it is itself on the National Register of Historic Places, and it's in the park, and it's, you know, all those sorts of things, I think that complicates things. I also think that, to be honest, it's the actual estimate of the costs of what it would be that can give people pause. I don't know if its complexity helps make it not on everybody's top 10 lists of what I must get done today. I think that the study that we were looking at last Thursday, when they had the public meeting, I guess maybe a better way to refer to it than a public hearing, I think what they were doing is doing a lot of chapter and verse on the different possible alternatives, and that would, of course, take time. But how much time it should take and how much time it will take, who knows, is, I guess, my honest response. I don't know.
And that was Meg McGuire, publisher and founder of Delaware Current, speaking with Tim Bruno just a couple of days ago. You can read the full story she's talking about at DelawareCurrents.org and hear that full interview on the Radio Chatskill program page at WJFFradio.org. And an additional program note, Tim Bruno will have a live interview with PennDOT about the Skinners Falls Bridge 1 week from today, Wednesday, May 8th at 10 a.m. on Radio Chatskill. Now, with more local reaction to last week's Skinners Falls public hearing, is Ruby Rayner from the River Reporter. Ruby, welcome back to the local edition.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
So, now, while we don't know yet exactly what is going to happen with the Skinners Falls Bridge, that's what the hearings are about, we do know something is going to happen at some point. Ruby, can you remind us what the options are that are on the table?
I can definitely do that. And as you said, yes, something definitely will be done. Doing nothing is not an option. As Meg McGuire pointed out, even doing nothing has a cost. And according to engineer Kate Farrow of the NTM Engineering, if nothing is done, the bridge will continue to disintegrate and eventually collapse. So, and the deterioration is already very much underway. As also was mentioned previously, the bridge has been closed since 2019, and even before then, they decreased the amount of capacity, like weight capacity, that was allowed on the bridge at different periods before 2019. And there's four options that are proposed at the Skinners Falls public hearing last week. And what will be done, what we don't know, but they will fall into these four different categories. So the first is a faithful restoration of the historic bridge. And the second is a modern new bridge with elements of the 1902 original tacked on so that it looks like the old bridge. The next one is a modern new bridge that looks like a new modern bridge. And then the last is no bridge at all. It's removed. So those are those four option kind of categories, and they're general now, but what will happen will fall into one of those four. So kind of something that looks like a historic restoration, something that emulates that but has the infrastructure of a modern bridge, and then one that just completely looks like a modern bridge, and then nothing at all.
Okay, and now we can turn our attention back to the local response, especially at this hearing last week. What are local folks saying about those options? What would they like to see?
Yeah, so just to give one The same Kate Farrow of NTM Engineering said that the traditional rehabilitation option in their mind comes first. And that was in line with the large majority of what people who attended the Thursday night meeting wanted. This is at the Narrowsburg Union, and there was a huge group of local residents that had a big banner that emulated this, that they wanted to, quote, save the Skinners Falls Bridge, and they chanted, whose bridge? Our bridge, and wanted to, you know, traditionally rehabilitate and keep that historical bridge. But not everyone was a fan of the all-historic, all-the-way option. Two residents who live right next to the bridge on the New York side said that their preference was for, like, the middle option, so a bridge that looks like the original. And this resident in particular had experience in construction, and he explained that, you know, this will look very beautiful, but be, you know, the infrastructure will be more sound and lasting, and that it will also, the middle option is more practical and cheaper, and, you know, you want something that's going to last. So those were some of the kind of varying, but there was definitely an overwhelming majority of people who spoke very, you know, had signs and sayings about ensuring that same traditional, fateful restoration of the bridge.
Yeah, I think one thing we can say for sure is, even as this process drags on, people are still interested in the question of what's going to happen with the bridge. But one of the other things about this hearing is just, like, its format. As listeners heard in that interview clip with Meg McGuire, the reporter from Delaware Currents likened the layout of this hearing to something like a science fair. People were moving around from station to station. How did people react to the format of the hearing itself?
Yes. So I think it definitely came as a surprise to some of the attendees of the hearing. The information session had kind of an open house format. There were engineers and planners from the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, PennDOT, which published the study. And then they had these kind of easels that were held up with posters and flow charts and photographs and timelines and kind of outlined these different options. And then members could kind of skim the posters and chat with a representative from PennDOT who was, like, standing next to it. There was, like, no chairs or kind of like a more conventional format of a presenter facing an audience. And I think a lot of people had come with prepared statements and expected that to be the case. One person kind of described the layout as, like, divide and conquer. And I think people definitely wanted to be heard and didn't expect it to be in that standout type of way. On the community network, some people called it, you know, like a sham because of how it was formatted, and that it wasn't, like, a good way for the public to be able to be heard by PennDOT. So, and that it was kind of like a you know, lengthening the process further.
Okay. And is there anything else on the Skinners Falls Bridge hearing story that you want folks to know?
No, we'll keep you posted of what's going to happen next with the different options and what folks are saying about it.
Okay. And moving on to other news, New York finally passed a budget. That's something that we're all still reacting to the last couple of weeks. And this impacts local schools. And I know you have a story about one of the local schools that now know a little bit more about where their funding's at.
Yeah, so a lot of the schools, like you said, were in this kind of limbo of trying to prepare their budgets, but not knowing what amount of state aid they were going to get because that budget hadn't gone through. And I talked about this last week. We touched on it, that there was one provision in particular that could have really cut the foundational aid from the state to different school districts, and it would have really affected them. Eldred Central School District, who would have been affected if this provision had been canceled, was able to kind of take a little bit of a sigh of relief for this year because it has stayed the same, their foundational aid from the state, to the dollar amount, actually. So they have nearly $4 million from the state in foundational aid, and that makes up about 20% of this year's proposed budget. So that will be that portion of the budget. And they're looking to increase their budget slightly at 1.6, and they're going to make up the rest about 66% in taxes. So I think that it was like a relief that for this year at least, that provision and that kind of rejiggering of the formula that assigns how much state aid the school districts get is not going to limit them. And there's a concern particularly that the new way that they're going to calculate this foundational aid from the state will affect rural schools more so than particularly other districts. So it's definitely continues to be a concern.
Well, and there's still tough decisions ahead. As the sub-headline of this article says, essentially, you know, sports may be the first thing to go. What are they looking at?
Yeah, so despite the fact that this year they're going to get the same foundational aid, these discussions about changing the way that they formulate how the school districts get the state foundational aid are ongoing, and they're expecting and preparing for there to be cuts. So they are kind of doing a multitude of different things to try to proactively prepare for that, and that's similar in other school districts that we cover too. And they've talked about reducing staff through attrition and seeing how they can kind of save money on software and reduce out-of-district placements is another thing. And, yeah, someone on the board had mentioned, like, you know, just kind of lamenting about the potential for those cuts that sports was going to be, like, the first thing to go. And oftentimes you hear when there's school budget cuts, sports, arts, and those are the things that people, you know, get very concerned about.
Okay, Al, staying with money but changing stories, you've got an article about casino revenue in New York and in Sullivan County in particular.
Yes, I do. And the most basic in essence is state gambling revenue is in New York State is up, but in Sullivan County, the casino tax revenue is down.
You know what my first question is, right?
What?
Why? Why yes. is that? I think everybody yes. wants to know.
Yes. You know, and as I, you know, I feel bad. I can't tell you exactly why, but I can tell you what the town of Thompson, which is where Resort World Catskill, the casino, is located. The town supervisor said, Mr. Reber, that when there isn't something that's happening, you know, affecting the tax revenue for the casino outwardly, you know, it's not aligning with the rest of the state, then it's something to look inward. So he kind of pointed at Resorts World Catskill itself and said that they kind of need to look inward, and he suggested remarketing and kind of taking a different approach, and was definitely expressed that the tax revenue that was projected has not nearly been as much as what was said it would be.
Yeah, really. You know, and this is something that this is just continuing a trend that's been the case for a number of years now. And for a while there, they thought it was mainly due to the pandemic. And now you can see other casinos are pulling ahead of the pack. Resorts World in Sullivan County is still lagging. Any other reaction to this? Any other thoughts?
Yeah, no, just in particular to what you were saying about that other casinos. Like, I think that it was, yes, the projections, they projected $309 million for 2019 when Resorts World Catskill first opened, which even then, I think there was some concern that that was an overestimation. And then obviously COVID affected that. But the 2023 American Gaming Association reported that New York State game revenue is up by nearly 12%. So this is, you know, we're accounting now for a bounce back from COVID, and it seems to be in a statewide sense bouncing back, and just not when it comes to Sullivan County and the Catskill Resort. So I'm going to continue to kind of ask why the casino Catskill Resort declined for comment, and so we don't have any information from them about why this might be at this time.
Okay, well, thank you for being on this, and thank you for giving us all this information, and just thank you for joining us.
Oh, yeah, of course. Thank you so much, Jason.
All the articles that we just talked about are up now at riverreporter.com, and you can hear Ruby Rayner again bringing you the news on the weekend right here on Radio Catskill. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, some more news from New York State and also Cinco de Mayo and Liberty. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Never Sink General Store, featuring deli sandwiches, gourmet specials, and catering. TheNeverSinkGeneralStore.com. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear something new by the Hollywood Film Orchestra and Skip Haller's Voodoo 5. Plus, there's music from Satan's Tiki Lounge, played by the Voodoo Organist. I'm Darryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
And this is the Local Edition on Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with us. New York Governor Kathy Hochul today defended the use of New York Police Department forces to quell increasingly violent student protests at Columbia University and the City College of New York last night. She says students aren't protesting, have rights too. Karen DeWitt has more. Excuse me, sorry about that.
Storming of a barricaded Hamilton Hall on the Columbia University campus. It resulted in around 300 arrests of students and other pro-Palestinian protesters. They were demonstrating against the war in Gaza and the school's financial ties to the State of Israel. Hochul, who praised the NYPD for acting professionally and fairly, says students have a First Amendment right to speak their minds. But she says when it devolves into violence, vandalism, destruction of property, and harassment, a line has been crossed.
Let me be clear. There is no circumstance where violence or vandalism is tolerated or acceptable, whether you're on a college campus or walking the streets of New York. Targeting Jewish students for harassment or abuse because of the actions of the Israeli government is also anti-Semitic and wrong. Glorifying the acts of Hamas on October 7th is reprehensible, as well as any circumstances racist or Islamophobic rhetoric towards your political opponents is not acceptable.
Hochul says most of the students on the campuses just want to finish their studies, take their exams, and in the case of college seniors, have an in-person graduation. Many college seniors today saw their high school graduations canceled because of the COVID pandemic.
Everyone is entitled to participate in a live commencement ceremony. We'll continue being there to support the students, the faculty, the staff, and support all New Yorkers who deserve to live in safety.
Hochul says state police are willing to help if local law enforcement in communities where the protests are occurring want them. But she says she does not envision sending in the New York National Guard at this time. The governor also says she has no sympathy for students who might be expelled for illegal behavior while protesting. She says they knew about the consequences, but did it anyway. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
This Saturday is May 4th, and the town of Liberty is going to be celebrating Cinco de Mayo, a holiday that's become more popular in the United States than in Mexico. It's now a celebration of Mexican-American culture. Patricio Rubio from Radio Catskill spoke with James Guara, Liberty's recreational director, about what's planned for the event and how people can participate. Here's what James had to say.
So the festival this year will be held on Liberty Main Street, right in front of the Liberty Main Street stage, in front of the Town Hall building. We're actually going to be up on the street between Law Street and School Street. We shut the street down.
What time does the festival start?
The festival starts at 10 a.m. and it concludes at 5 p.m.
Right. What can folks expect when they come to the Cinco de Mayo Festival?
This is actually our second year running the festival. Last year was our first year running it. This year, we have a whole line of entertainment, authentic Mexican dances that are going to be scheduled starting around 1 o'clock. We have a little square on the street with bleacher systems so people can sit on the bleachers and they can watch the different dances. We have some authentic Spanish bands that are coming and performing. The Rotary Club will be present. They will have a slew of different games for kids for free that they can participate in and win little prizes like lollipops and stuff like that. We will have face painters, tattoo artists on site. About 45 vendors will be present from everything from food to jewelry to all kinds of different knickknacks, reptiles, food trucks. So it's going to be a day for the whole family to come out and enjoy multiple different things. And the whole purpose really is to embrace the Hispanic culture that has undertaken our town here in a positive way. Get people to understand what Cinco de Mayo is and incorporate them into our community. That's the whole focus.
Right. You say this is the second year that this is happening. As you mentioned, we have a growing population in Sullivan County and also in Liberty. So this is a great way to celebrate. As we know, Cinco de Mayo is a Mexican holiday celebrating the victory over the Second French Empire at the Battle of Puebla. I know it's more popular in the United States than it is Mexico, but it also has become sort of a Mexican heritage sort of celebration. And having 45 vendors out of this location on Saturdays seems like a lot of people are going to be there.
Yeah, that's great. I know we have a little bit of a weather issue, but we're going to push through it and use the prayer guide, and hopefully it stays away until after the festival's over.
Yeah, I do see that there is a slight chance of rain on Saturday, but of course, you know, that shouldn't stop the festivities. There's all good stuff happening on May 4th, Saturday, starting at 10 a.m. on Main Street in Liberty. James, thank you so much for talking to me about this event that's happening in Liberty. It, you know, as it says, the second year that this happened, it seems like it's going to go on more. It seems like I saw pictures last year on Facebook. This could become a yearly annual event for Liberty. So again, James, thank you so much for talking to me. We're talking to James Guerrera, the director of the Town of Liberty Parks and Recreational Department. Thank you so much for talking to me about the Cinco de Mayo Festival that's happening in Liberty. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Patricio. Big thanks to Ruby Rayner and Meg McGuire and Tim Bruno for helping out with the show. This has been the Local Edition. I've been your host, Jason Dole, and that's it for this show. We're done. I want to thank you so much for being here with us. Thank you for listening. Do keep on listening on air. Live streaming at WJFFradio.org on your smart speaker. We'll be back again tomorrow evening. We've got the Daily coming up, and then after that, it's 2 hours of the Retro Cocktail Hour. Don't be deceived by the name. It's a two-hour-long show. 2 hours of great music from Daryl Brogdon after we get through the rest of the news with the Daily. And in that last story, the weather was mentioned, so let's do take a quick look at the weather. Tomorrow is going to be cooler than it was today. Clear tonight, overnight low down around 50. Tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high of 71, so a bit cooler tomorrow, but still pretty warm. Few clouds tomorrow night, overnight low down to 46. Looking ahead to Saturday when there's lots of events happening this weekend, there is less of a chance of rain during the day than there was even when I checked this rain forecast earlier today. We're now seeing about a 10 to 20% chance of rain right on through until about 3 o'clock. And then in the later afternoon into the evening, that chance of rain goes up to about 50%. So there may be some rain, but we'll keep an eye on that and hope that maybe it moves in another direction or holds off till after the festivities, which include the Cinco de Mayo event in Liberty. Also, Kite Day is happening at SUNY Sullivan and Loch Sheldrake, and Radio Catskill will be there as well. So if you come out for Kite Day, make sure to stop by and say hi to us. This has been the Local Edition. Thank you so much. Stay tuned. We got the Daily coming up next.
Hey, it's Cassie from Rare Pair Radio. playing you the fruit of all things sweet, Fridays, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., mostly female artists, from rock, funk, punk, pop, and more. All rare, only on WJFF Radio Catskill.
Like a radio station here, just turn it on, you'll be gone.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH, Monticello.